This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. Harriet Williamson is the show's producer. Ann Garrels is no stranger to dangerous and difficult reporting assignments. She reported from Moscow before and after the breakup of the Soviet Union, from Chechnya and Kosovo and Afghanistan. Her latest assignment took her to Baghdad late last year as the nation was drawing closer to a United States invasion. Less than 6 months after those attacks began, she has put her thoughts and accounts and memories into a review of her tours of duty in Iraq for National Public Radio, a book titled Naked in Baghdad. Now, the title of the book alludes to one level, to an odd precaution that Garrels took to help her send uncensored reports back to the States, even during the most severe crackdowns on journalists during the last days of the Saddam regime. It could, on another level, bring to mind the peril that she and the other members of the diminishing press corps were exposed to in that time, beyond the constant pressure from government minders and other bureaucrats, one of whom develops into a true friend as we read through the book. Ann Garrels joins us this afternoon to talk about her experiences during those months over the last winter and spring as the Iraq of Saddam Hussein gave way to the current American occupation. You can join us in the conversation this afternoon. Our phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana are 333-9455, outside the area toll-free at 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Your calls are welcome. Ann Garrels joins us this afternoon from Chicago, where she'll be holding a book signing a little bit later tonight, and we'll give you those details at the end of the show. Good afternoon, Ann.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. I'm sure Chicago pales in comparison to the excitement of Baghdad.
Oh, I wish I just could see more of the city. I'm sort of flying through.
But once you're through with this nationwide fly-through tour, you're going back to Iraq, correct?
Yes.
And what will the subjects be then?
Well, you know, twofold. One, how Iraqis are dealing with and handling the situation, and the other side, you know, how the Americans are dealing with it.
We may have to explain the title again, first of all. Naked in Baghdad is the title of the book, and you mention in the book the constant pressure that you got from people in the government who obviously wanted their side of the story to be told, and you had quite a few restrictions as in Iraq as you did your job.
Yes, I mean, it was, you know, before the war, it was a very difficult place to work, a police state, a Stalinist, I sometimes thought. And they tried to monitor and hamper our ability to work as best they could. We were allowed to have satellite phones, our means of communication, my only means of broadcasting, and the officials wanted us to use these phones at the information ministry. Well, as the war approached, we knew that the information ministry was clearly a target, and most of us smuggled our phones out to the hotel. The question was how to hide them from Saddam security people who blanketed the city, and certainly the hotel, the Palestine Hotel, where we were all sort of herded in the end. So I came up with this perhaps a pathetic but necessary ruse that I would broadcast in the dark, and I wouldn't have any clothes on, so that when the thugs came to the door, I could sort of poke my shoulder out and say, oh, you've just woken me up, and then hope that they would let me shut the door in time to put some clothes on and perhaps get enough time to hide the phone.
And that was, you also were able to take advantage of cultural differences there, too, because of the attitude toward women.
Yes, I was playing on cultural differences in the hope that, you know, they would not burst in on a naked woman.
How did you deal with those minders in other ways? Were these people who were true believers? Were they people who let you off on occasion? How do you get around trying to send an unbiased report back to the States with all that pressure?
Well, the Minders, whether they were true believers or not, were certainly frightened of the Saddam regime. I think some of them were indeed true believers, or they had been bought off. And they did their best to make sure that we, you know, didn't get off the reservation, that they were with us most of the time. However, at the end, you know, at the end of an afternoon, you'd say, you know, I'm finished. I'm going to the hotel to write, and they would be more than happy to go off and do their own thing. At which point, you could then try and subtly disappear under the guise of going shopping, buying, you know, supplies, or just try and go see Iraqis who would be brave enough to see you.
And that, I assume, is where you got some of your best stories.
Absolutely. No question.
Tell us a little about one, you know, a couple of those stories that may that you remember the most from that, who that you made the most impression on you.
Well, they happened at odd moments. I mean, sometimes it would just, I mean, it was just a glimpse at life. You would get in it. Sometimes I would use a driver, sometimes I wouldn't. I would just hail a taxi. And quite frequently people would speak English. And so you know, people would begin to talk about their life, how they, you know, they were afraid of the future. They were afraid of what would happen when the Americans came in. They would, you know, a driver would pass a Saddam palace and say, you know, don't look too closely. It's dangerous. And then utter, often very frank evaluations of Saddam, saying he doesn't give a damn about any of us. He's ruined the country. The war with Kuwait was unnecessary. The sanctions are terrible. And you began to see how, you know, people's lives had been and how people felt about their own lives and about Saddam and how fearful they were and how caged they felt. One of the most extraordinary moments in some ways was immediately on my arrival in October. Saddam had released all prisoners, or so he had said, from the prisons. This was a highly controversial move, and he was gambling that Iraqis, since so many Iraqis were being held in prison for nothing but opposing him, that this would be a popular move. Of course, it also released lots of real criminals into the streets. But there were people who were not released, and those were more often than not political prisoners. And that the first day I was there, I was driving through and I saw this group of people, hundreds of people standing by the side of the street. It's hard to call it a demonstration. They weren't shouting and screaming. They were really just standing silently, but it was quite profound. And I looked at my driver at the time. The Minder was, in fact, in another car behind us. And I said, you know, what is this? And the driver answered, which was quite extraordinary, and said, the families of political prisoners. They are trying to find out what has happened to the people who Saddam has not released. And it was at that point that I realized this driver, who then became a very close friend, might just be a real asset and a real help to me in the coming months, and he was.
That's important, to find people you can trust in a place like that, I'm sure.
It's important. Every foreign correspondent, in whatever country, under whatever conditions, looks for someone like that. You always need local eyes and ears, people who are open, who you know, are brave but not so brave they'll get you killed.
Or get themselves killed. They've got a lot of
risk. Or themselves, precisely. And it's, no matter whether you speak the language or not, it's not just a question of language translation. It's somebody who can give you real access to the society and in the broadest possible way. And we rely on those people.
And you spent a good deal of the book talking about your relationship with that driver, who you call Amer in the book, as an assumed name. He obviously must have taken a lot of risk upon himself to do this. What is it that motivates somebody in that way?
You know, it's a good question, and it's different in different places. And you know, I think Amer, as I call him in the book, you know, realized that the world was going to change. And it was fairly evident, even as early as October, that there probably would be a war. And he loathed Saddam. Saddam had destroyed his life in many ways. But he was also, he wasn't sure whether he wanted the Americans to come in. He wasn't sure if it would be better for the Iraqis to do it. He wanted to show me how complex Iraq was.
Is that, that obviously showed in your reporting as well. He becomes a source, I guess, as well as just a driver.
Well, ultimately, during the war, he was key, because sometimes the Iraqi authorities basically would sort of locked us in the hotel and we weren't able to go out and survey what had been bombed, what was going on, and he helped me enormously. He also, and for reasons I did not entirely understand initially, had a good knowledge of things military. And there were occasions when we went out together and were taken out by the Iraqis to see what they said was an American bombing site where civilians had been killed. And he, on one occasion picked up some shell casings from debris from the bombing, and he looked at the material and said, "That's not an American bomb. That's an Iraqi rocket." He was remarkable, and I had found out over the months that he was a very careful and astute observer. Extremely careful about facts, perhaps because he had lived in a society where facts counted for nothing, that he became a real stickler and was a superb guide.
He, at one point in the book, I believe it was near the end of the fighting, that he had actually gone out and conducted some interviews on your behalf.
Yes, there were many moments in during the bombing where, as I say, we were basically not allowed to go out, or even if we could go out, the city was blanketed with Ba'ath Party members and security people, and many of them in plain clothes. And there was no question that if I were to go out as a Western reporter, even if I could get out of the hotel, I would have hurt the people I wanted to go see. My very presence in their neighborhood, at their house, would have drawn, to put it mildly, unwanted attention. And so on occasion I asked Amr, I gave him a tape recorder, I told him who I wanted him to go see, I gave him a list of questions, and he would go on occasion do this for me.
When you went out, how did you get those people to open up and talk to you? Was it a difficult process? Were they very willing to talk, depending on the security conditions?
Well, people were frightened. It was easier because I did not have a television camera. It was clear I was a foreign woman, Sometimes I didn't carry a tape recorder with me. That would have been far too loaded. And so I would go through marketplaces, and sometimes people working in the market would take me into the back away from the crowds and open up. And many times they were simply much too frightened. I mean, it was the conditions were very difficult.
But obviously, being a radio reporter, you had some built-in as you mentioned, some advantages to
yes, like
somebody
print
traveling
reporters,
the crew.
We were more discreet, if you will, by the means with which we worked.
How did you work with the press corps in the field? You had a few observations about how the rest of the press corps worked too, because you're obviously working as competitors, but in the midst of your situation where you're facing bombing, there's some camaraderie that builds up.
Oh, there is camaraderie all the time. I mean, I've been doing this for 25-plus years, and many of the reporters, you know, I know, they're friends. And Some of us are not immediate competitors, for instance. I mean, perhaps NPR and television might be considered more of an immediate competitor, but often I'll work with, say, somebody who works with a weekly newspaper or a British reporter who's an old friend or a print reporter who, when we don't see each other as immediate competitors, we do stories in our own way. And two minds, often in a very difficult situation, is better than one. And there is a real camaraderie, as you know, when you, especially when you know the people well, you've worked with them for years. And there are some, but the press corps also now is huge. Not just, I just don't mean American journalists, but foreign journalists of all stripes. It's a very unwieldy, you know, enormous group. I mean, at one point, there are probably well over 500 journalists milling around the information ministry in Baghdad, and you don't really know who a lot of those people are, but you do, there are select colleagues. And certainly, you know, when it came down to those of us who stayed in Baghdad, I mean, when we finally realized there were, you know, as the clock ticked down and President Bush's deadline was nearing, and we looked around and went, oh my God, there are only 16 of us Americans left. There was a real sense of camaraderie and support, and people making sure that each other, we each made sure that, you know, the others were okay. And if you look around at a press conference to make sure everybody was there and that they hadn't somehow disappeared, and we would double check facts with each other, because we couldn't, you know, see we couldn't all be in all places in the city at the same time. So it was a great group and an amazing group when you think about it. NPR, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books.
that one caught my eye. Not exactly a late breaking journalistic source.
But you know, great. I mean, these were great people with great experience, and I mean, not to mention, you know, The New York Times and The Washington Post. I mean, a remarkable reporter. I mean, John Burns for The New York Times and Anthony Chedid for The Washington Post, who's just a superb reporter and speaks Arabic and knows the region very well.
How did you manage to stay there then, with all the things that were going on and the government breathing down your neck, the Iraqi government? How did you manage to stay?
Well, clearly the Iraqi government, I mean, it was flip-flopping by the second. It didn't know whether it wanted us to stay or it didn't want us to stay, and I mean, that was a problem in and of itself in the days running up to the bombing, not to mention our own bosses back at home who were, you know, nervous about our safety.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hard for me to – I mean, I asked NPR to stay. They did not ask me. And it was very hard to tell them flat out, I know I will be okay. I did not know I would be okay. But I thought I had a really good chance of surviving just fine. I mean, I have no death wish. Let me just make that clear.
But it obviously, I'm sure, caused some interesting conversations to take place back in Washington.
Oh, yes. I mean, there were very interesting conversations. My husband trusted my judgment, though, and I think, you know, when they found, you know, when my bosses found out that he was okay with it, and I did, I had been there for many months on and off. I did have Amr. I think in some ways I was probably naive about, you know, how well we would be able to, I mean, there were, Amr and I had discussed trying to find some kind of a safe house, renting an apartment in his name or someone's name where we could hide. But it became clear as the bombing approached that that was not going to be possible, because the city, you know, Saddam's people were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there would have been no way, frankly, to really have disappeared. But I wasn't really afraid. I mean, and I wasn't afraid of the bombing. Everyone's always astonished at that. But the, you know, we'd seen the bombing in 91 and again in 98 when the U.S. had bombed a second time. And the bombing was very accurate and went for very specific government targets. There was very little collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was much more true this time around, as it turned out. I mean, the targets were very specifically Saddam's palaces, military installations, intelligence installations, security installations, and the phone company.
You did have a situation, though, by the end of the fighting that the hotel did come under attack at one point.
Yes, but that was not a bomb, Tom.
Ah.
That was a tank shell.
Okay.
Yes, that was quite a shock, in fact. The Palestine Hotel, after the American troops came in on the ground, and frankly, from that moment on, I mean, when the action shifted from the air to the ground, it became much more dangerous. There were firefights in the city, and the Palestine Hotel was hit by a tank shell, which the military has justified, but about which there are still a lot of questions. The Palestine Hotel was where all the journalists were. We were not allowed to be, you know, sort of live anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very distinctive architectural structure. Yes, indeed, the military said, but, they saw the glint of binoculars from the roof. Well, I mean, glint of binoculars, there were journalists on every balcony watching the firefight down below. It's one thing, you know, maybe to have been caught on the streets, but, two of my colleagues were killed three flights above me. The report that the Pentagon released, it released only a statement. The report is classified, but they certainly gave a lot of contradictory reports about why a tank took off and hit the Palestine. Initially, they said that there was shooting, which there was. I mean, all of us were on the balconies and on the roof watching. There was no outgoing fire from the hotel, and in fact, we didn't see any in the immediate vicinity either. And the Pentagon kept changing its story. And there's some embedded reporters who were there said that, when, in fact, the tank let off and hit the hotel, an officer was heard to say, "What the blank was somebody doing hitting the Palestine Hotel?" making it quite clear he at least knew what it was. It was a tragic mistake.
Anne Gerrels is our guest. The book that she has just written on her experience as NPR's correspondent in Baghdad is called Naked in Baghdad. Your questions are welcome, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we have a caller on line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I heard that contemporaneous reporting, and I'm glad you covered that. But, yeah, it wasn't the glint of binoculars. The first line was that it was firing, and they stuck to that for quite a while, if I recall.
Yes, but then they backed off of it.
Mm-hmm. But it's been investigated by a variety of things. I just heard a report from Aidan White from Belgium, an international federation of journalists, available to local listeners on Democracy Now! This afternoon here. But and he sort of goes through the catalog of the other journalists who were killed. So I don't know. I guess there's a report today in the English. I don't know if you knew Terry Lloyd, because he was a British film crew for ITN.
And he, yes.
The story is there's been an investigation that I guess ITN sponsored, I'm not sure, that says that he was shot first, strafed when he was in a very visibly identified television van, and then he was taken by an Iraqi in a minivan flying a white flag, I believe. And then he was strafed again, and he was killed the second time. So this is another one that the U.S. isn't being very forthcoming on.
The Committee to Protect Journalists continues to investigate all of this, too, and to raise questions about, what exactly are the rules of engagement. I mean, there's no question that, mistakes are made. Troops are killed in friendly fire as well. It's not. I don't think any of us think it's deliberate. But there have been, instances where, troops are firing wildly, and it's not just journalists, unfortunately, who are the victims. Unfortunately, in the aftermath, there have been too many unfortunate incidents where Iraqi civilians, bystanders, have been killed because the raids have gone badly wrong, in part because they were badly organized, And the military has begun to, in a tacit acknowledgement, not an open acknowledgement, that perhaps their methods were not the best, that their policing was perhaps a little heavy-handed. They've begun to make the checkpoints much more noticeable, because in many instances I know that American officials, not just journalists, have almost run through checkpoints because they couldn't see them. And, you know, the American troops were about to open fire, but if you can't see a checkpoint, how are you supposed to stop? And in many cases, Iraqi civilians have been killed. And, you know, these are the methods and the ways the U.S. troops are working are being changed to some degree. And, I mean, it's a difficult situation all round, but the problem is if you're trying to win the hearts and minds, it's not helpful, when innocent civilians are killed. And then, of course, the U.S. has taken the position that it will not discuss Iraqi civilian casualties, which has only reinforced the view that Americans don't care about Iraqis.
All right, thanks for your call. Let's go on to line two in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yeah, there was a lot of reasons given for why we went to war. You talked about Saddam Hussein being a Stalin-esque system or something to that effect. There was talk of WMDs and connections with Saddam, with bin Laden, and a lot of people thought it was for oil, and some people say it's for democracy in the Middle East. I was just wondering if you thought that it was all worth it for the Iraqi people, and if you think the Iraqi people are going to come through and be able to have any kind of control over their country in the next, say, 5-10 years.
I know that puts you on the spot a little as being an observer or an analyst rather than a reporter.
I mean, you know, my job, frankly, was as a witness to describe how Iraqis, especially from, I mean, because I had one small window on all of this to look, and I was in Iraq. The problem now is that, Iraqis would say, why the rush? Many who even desperately wanted an end to Saddam Hussein, and most did. Many Sunni Muslims who, in theory, had benefited from his largesse, they wanted an end to it. It was the situation in the country had become worse and worse and worse. I mean, not just because of outside pressure and sanctions, but because of Saddam's own paranoia at home. Iraqis knew themselves and know themselves well. They knew that in some ways, once the strong man was gone, the country was going to erupt. That criminals would, flood the streets. That if security and if the United States did not exert complete control initially, that there would be looting, which there was, and the looting went on, much to Iraqis' astonishment and horror, for a month after American troops arrived on the ground, making it that much harder for Iraqis to take control of their own lives. I mean, imagine your own town. If every government office, with the exception of the oil ministry, which is the only ministry which was not truly destroyed, imagine if every government office was looted, every record destroyed. You're not rebuilding, you're starting from scratch, and that's what's going on. It's a difficult, difficult situation.
Well, that destruction of records, I wonder if that isn't Ba'athist or...
Of course. Your point well taken. It was just people coming out and taking their revenge on the regime. But I think there were clearly elements of the regime who were taking advantage of the former regime who were taking advantage of the chaos to make it that much harder for anybody to rebuild Iraq and to create that much more chaos in which the American occupiers would be working. And I mean, that has been the methodology since then. Whoever is conducting the attacks, it's making it that much more difficult for the Americans to restore electricity, gain confidence. The problem is that there aren't, you know, it sounds like there are a lot of troops on the ground, 130,000. But in fact, per capita, that is less than the international coalition had in the Balkans, in what could be argued was a simpler situation than Iraq.
Let's move on to line one right now, and caller in Urbana, good afternoon.
Yeah, I have two questions. Maybe three. The thing, yesterday on 60 Minutes 2, they had this thing about with Dan Rather out in the hinterland. He was with a group trying to find Saddam Hussein, and they showed Saddam Hussein's mother's village. And I was just shocked to see how poor the people were, the mud huts and all. I don't know if you want to comment about that.
Iraq is in many ways you would be surprised on the one hand at how middle class much of Iraq is, but there are also extremely poor areas, and the Mother's Village is a particularly poor area. The country was on the upswing in the 60s and 70s. Education, literacy began to soar, even under the early days of Saddam. Healthcare, education, it improved. You had 88% literacy by, say, 1985. But it was new literacy, which quickly erodes if it's not supported. And when Saddam, you know, basically went bankrupt in the Iran-Iraq War, and then things got even worse with the invasion of Kuwait and its subsequent sanctions, literacy dropped to 45%, women taking the biggest hits. The villages sunk into real poverty, and that's what you're seeing now. Unfortunately, though, there's the argument from the administration that they were surprised at how poor the country was and at how fragile the infrastructure is and how much it will cost to fix it. I don't buy that their surprise, they should not have been surprised. The United Nations, aid organizations, and journalists had long documented the demise of the country, and that was in part what the sanctions were all about, to try and squeeze Saddam into basically giving up.
Yeah, and I've heard that people like Robert Baer, the ex-CIA agent, was giving accurate reports. But I want to ask you two quick other questions. One is, what could you say about what you heard from the people there about their attitude toward Chalabi? And then the last question, and I'll hang up, is that since you were in Kosovo too, I was just curious if you've what the buzz is amongst you journalists as to Wesley Clark, because I'm reading a lot of negative stuff about him, so I'm going to sneak that question in, and I'll hang up.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
which one to start with?
Let's see. The first one, Wesley Clark. I'm not in a really good position to deal with that one. I'm not trying to take a dodge entirely, but on Iraqis, what was it?
Their attitudes toward Mr. Chalabi.
Oh, Chalabi. It's a great question. It's a great question. Forgive me. There's a lot of resentment by Iraqis in general to the arrival of the exiles, which should not really surprise anyone. On the one hand, Iraqis were thrilled, you know, that their countrymen managed to get out and make their lives outside the country. They were the lucky ones. They got to have a decent life somewhere else. But once you leave the country, you know, people who sort of stayed at home and suffered aren't really thrilled to see people coming back, especially sort of with the backing, and what they would say is the unfair backing of the Americans to come and affect the new political situation. You know, their attitude is, hey, wait a minute, we stayed here and suffered. They also really don't know who Chalabi is. Most of them don't, and there are some, many reports that, he was finally thrown out of Jordan, because of financial scandals. His reputation is somewhat tarnished. Chalabi is now, of course, having been supported by the Pentagon. He was flown into Iraq. He had many militia figures who were trained by the Americans in Hungary, the Free Iraqi Freedom Fighters or whatever, who came in and then they had to sort of get the Americans had to sort of say, I'm sorry, no, you can't have this militia after all. And Chalabi now is the snake who's sort of turning around and biting the Americans. Taking advantage of the people in the United Nations, saying, we should give the Iraqis the Iraqi Governing Council immediate sovereignty, and let them have much more power. And Chalabi is now saying, yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, having been supported by the U.S., he's now saying, no, we want more power. The U.S. should give us much more power. And Chalabi is probably the wiliest and strongest among the 25-member governing council, but by no means the most popular in Iraq. Nobody in the council really has yet developed any true standing in the country. So he's trying to basically, bulldoze everybody so that he can take advantage of the situation.
What's the general feeling among people about the governing council? There's some suspicion, obviously, with some players there.
Yeah, suspicions, but give it time. The governing council, in many ways, has been given a great deal of power, which it has not effectively used, because it's a group of highly disparate people, but it is indeed representative of the various factions within Iraq. And they now finally have named ministers. And that gives them a great deal of authority in running the country, in showing that they can develop, run, and make the ministries function. Chalabi, in my view, and in the view of many Iraqis, this is a crude power grab.
And obviously, there's a spectrum of people who are both on the governing council and those who want to have a share of the power among religious and secular, all types of different parties.
That's right. So it's going to be an awkward, an awkward transition. I mean, you have a 25-member governing body made up of people from all walks of life. I mean, and all sectors of, as you say, religious, Shiite, Sunni, Kurd, Turkmen, you name it. It's an unwieldy group, but it's a necessary transition.
Let's go to line three in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Ann Garrels, it is a real pleasure to talk to you. You have been on the front line. I have a comment with regards the impossibility of trying to square an occupation force bringing democracy in as I suppose we could say Adolf Hitler tried to bring fascism into Poland in September 2nd of 1939. This just doesn't work. Chris Hedges, veteran New York Times correspondent, who has the unique Illinois distinction of being kicked off the Rockford College podium at a commencement exercise for talking about the addiction to war. To what extent would you say that you are an addict to warfare? This is Chris's main hypothesis, and I'll let you go. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I am no addict to warfare, and maybe Chris just—I don't know. Sometimes I don't. I honestly don't understand Chris's book. There are war junkies, but frankly, I did not start out covering wars. If anything, the wars unfortunately found all of us, including me as a foreign correspondent. I mean, there are a lot of people who were happily assigned to London, Paris, wherever, who are now sitting in Baghdad, and they will never see those cushy assignments that they thought they had. In 91, I was in the Balkans for a long time. My passion was the former Soviet Union. I had been in any number of places in the former republics where wars were going on, whether it was Abkhazia or Georgia or, you know, Tajikistan, you name it. And in fact, in 94, I went back to Moscow, hoping that I could cover the building of a new country. Of course, what happened? I arrived in 94, and almost immediately Chechnya happened. I did not go because of Chechnya. It happened, and unfortunately, in this, and then 9/11 happened, and I was assigned to Afghanistan. I did not run off there of my own will, and all of us, and we don't have a huge bench at NPR. All of us are taking turns at this. It's inadvertently I became, if you will, good at this, but it was not by design.
Getting back briefly to the book, when you wrote it, were there any qualms about writing a book in the midst of history actually taking place?
Oh, sure. The whole thing was bizarre, in truth. I mean, I didn't anticipate there would only be 16 of us, and I certainly did not anticipate the attention when I came home. That was perhaps the most astonishing to me, that I was sort of taste of the week when I got home. And, agents and, you name it, approached me to write a book. And that was the last thing I had in my mind. And I just wanted to sort of disappear and be with my family. But a friend of mine who is a publisher, who knows me well, who had read my husband's emails, and they're a part of the book, approached us. And it seemed a way to answer people's questions. People tend to glamorize this job, glamorize the decisions. I don't know. They turn you into something you're not. And I thought maybe at this point it was not bad to put the diary together. And it's one window on one small period of time. But I also knew what was valuable was that Iraqis had very well anticipated the aftermath. And it was clear immediately the bombing stopped, immediately Saddam's forces apparently evaporated, that America was in for something it had not anticipated. American troops, had basically been told that this was not going to be that hard once they got into Baghdad. Rumsfeld was prepared to rather quickly reduce the number of troops from 130,000 down to 30,000. Iraqis knew that it was going to be much harder, and so I realized that there had been a much more value to staying from October on than I had ever anticipated.
Let's get one really quick question since we're short on time. Line 4 in Charleston, good afternoon.
Yes, this is kind of an overview. Say everything's successful in Iraq, then we move to Iran and to Syria and all the Middle East, and we democratize those people. And then the onset of market economy and capitalism ensues, and then we revert right back to the horrible poverty that even exists in the U.S., and to think that that is successful is just insane. Thank you.
Well, I think you've summed up, let's just put it this way, how complicated the world is. And I am not a blanket believer in the idea of globalization, that everybody will become homogenized.
Before we go, you spend not only it's an essential part of the book, the interspersion of the email notes that your husband Vint Lawrence sent to your friends and relatives while you were in Baghdad. That obviously was some help on your part to have that contact communication available to you while you were out there in Baghdad.
Listen, I've got a great husband. I couldn't have, I've got a wonderful home to come back to, and a great husband who supports me. You know, everybody works out their own lives their own way. And people ask me, God, why does your husband let you do this? You know, each person, you know, each couple has their own way of living and their own way of dealing with things. But, you know, this is the way we've sorted out our lives. And I just, he's terrific. And it also turns out he's a wonderful writer.
And girls, it's been great. I wish we had another hour.
Thank you.
Ann Gerrels is NPR's correspondent who is going to be heading back to Iraq in due time after a tour in support of her book Naked in Baghdad. It is out at stores everywhere from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And she is signing books this evening in Chicago at the First United Methodist Church. That's downtown at 77 West Washington. It's open to the public, starts at 7. And there will be a brief interview there with Gretchen Helfrich, who's the host of Odyssey up at Chicago Public Radio, a show that we carry on the weekend here at AM 580. And once again, that's open to the public as well at the First United Methodist Church in Chicago. Ann Gerrels has been our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. It is 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. And with those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.